Morning. Taking care of the pregnant patient with abdominal emergencies is quite challenging. We're going to go over some of those challenges. I'd like to take a little bit of time afterwards to consider two specific entities, appendicitis and gallbladder disease. And finally, I'll want to go over a few special considerations in caring for these patients. There are approximately 6 million pregnancies in this country annually, and about 1 in 500 of those will require some kind of general surgical intervention. Is that better? This chart is actually quite old, but this distribution of presentations is actually remarkably constant. And so that amounts to about 12,000 patients in this country a year. And if you divide that into all the hospitals there are in this country, that's about 2 per hospital per year. And so most of us that take general surgical call will encounter a pregnant patient every couple of years. Well, getting that call to take care of a pregnant patient with an abdominal catastrophe is one of those things that pulls most of us, it's not working, outside of our comfort zone. And so these cases are challenging, and they're challenging for a variety of reasons. One of those reasons is they're high risk. They're high risk for the mother, and in this population base out of Taiwan, you can see that the maternal risk of death is approximately 4 times higher just by virtue of being pregnant for the same surgical disease. In a similar population database out of the National Healthcare Service in the UK shows a nearly 5% relative risk increase for the same surgical disease just by virtue of being pregnant. So the relative risk to the mother, the absolute risk is still low, but the relative risk is 4 to 5 times higher than in the non-pregnant state. There's also a risk to the fetus. Similar database out of the UK shows a number of relative risks for adverse fetal outcomes, but I'll call your attention to the risk of fetal loss is approximately 1%. So 1 out of 100 operations we do on a pregnant patient will result in fetal loss. Now, some of those fetuses would be lost anyway, but this represents a significant risk to the baby. And in this chart, you can see the different relative risks for various adverse outcomes as a function of trimester. And you can see that as later trimesters, the risk goes up. Appendicitis is a special case. There's just something about pus and a uterus coexisting in the pelvis that appears to be bad. And so the risk of fetal loss for appendicitis, simple appendicitis, is 2%. That goes up to 6% in complicated appendicitis. And interestingly, in this study, 4% of patients who had negative abies had fetal loss. And it's unclear from this data whether that's a complication of a negative exploration or the underlying surgical disease that got you into the operating room in the first place. But for all comers, it's approximately 4% fetal loss rate with appendicitis. There's also risk medical legally. Now, I could not find any data on the increased medical legal risk, but as there are 2 lives at stake for the same surgical decision making, your exposure is higher. These cases are stressful. You know, the same surgical disease that would be routine for most patients is suddenly a highly stressful event in the setting of pregnancy. And honestly, the stress level affects the surgeon. Making the diagnosis is challenging. The hallmarks of abdominal processes, surgical processes, pain, distension, and GI disturbances are commonplace in pregnancy. Similarly, the findings of tachycardia, tachypnea, and hypotension are also normal physiologic changes in pregnancy. I want to talk a brief moment. You heard about the blood pressure changes in pregnancy. The reason for the blood pressure drop is really complex, involves volume expansion and vasodilation. But interestingly, the diastolic pressure drops to a greater extent than the systolic pressure, and this translates to a larger pulse pressure, which also corresponds to a bigger stroke volume and a greater cardiac output. And I think the important take home from that is if a pregnant patient doesn't have strong palpable pulses, you should seriously consider that they require volume resuscitation. Clearly, the location of the viscera may be altered by the pregnant uterus. You saw this diagram before. This is really based from a 1932 barium enema study, and more recent evidence shows that the majority of patients with appendicitis have their pain in the right lower quadrant, and this actually was a prospective study looking at surgical patients, and the location of the appendix isn't significantly different throughout pregnancy. But 10 to 15% of patients do have significant displacement of their appendix, and that needs to be kept in mind. Regardless of whether the viscera is displaced or not, the presence of the gravid uterus clearly alters the physical exam. And you also heard that there is significant maternal blood volume expansion, and this is really important. As you heard, the mother can lose a lot of blood without showing signs of shock, and you have to keep that in mind. Y count of 14,000 is normal, and if your patient has a creatinine of 0.8, they probably have early acute kidney injury already. Radiology, we're going to hear about that in greater detail later. Ultrasound is great, it's safe, it's readily available. Unfortunately, it is operator dependent, and it's frequently non-diagnostic in pregnancy. One of the little side points I'd like to encourage you, if you can, particularly with appendicitis, if it is positive, have your technologist mark the side of the appendix. It can be quite helpful. MRI is the gold standard, but it is not universally available at all times. And the images are less familiar to most surgeons, and after all, the surgeon is the one making the decision in the middle of the night. So you have to be convinced yourself as to what you're looking at. And while CT scans ionizing radiation has relegated it to a third line study, I want to point out that you'll hear this more later, you know, outside of the first trimester, the risk of ionizing radiation is predominantly the risk of future childhood cancers. And that's quite scary and disturbing for most mothers. But in reality, the risk is low, and the administration of a CT scan probably accounts for a 1 in 500 chance of an additional childhood cancer. But I want to point out that the decision-making we are forced into carries a relative risk of 1 in 50 to 120, or 1 in 50, 1 in 25 chance, absolutely, of fetal demise. And that's that appendicitis date I mentioned to you before. So basically, we're weighing decisions that are an order of magnitude more likely to kill the fetus than a CT scan will at some point in the future. And so if you are faced with a complicated case and you really don't know if you need to go to the operating room or not, and your ultrasound and MRI are not helping you, get the CT scan. All right, every pregnant patient, by definition, has a difficult airway. The mucosa is edematous, and it is said that there are mal and potty scar ups by at least one. There's hyperemia, mucus production, reflux. All that translates to a tenfold increase in airway loss. I have actually performed a surgical airway in this setting, and I do advise you to be at the head of the bed paying attention if your patients are undergoing anesthetic induction. Alpha agonists. They're an incredibly important agent to anesthesiologists to combat the sympatholysis of anesthetic induction. And in the critical care world, there is a move away from fluid resuscitation and sepsis and early aggressive use of vasopressors. But the uterine circulation is maximally vasodilated. And as you've heard, the saturations involved are very low. So the fetus requires the high blood flow to ensure adequate oxygen transport. The maternal circulation does have alpha receptors on it, and so alpha agonists will reduce uterine blood flow. And so the old mainstay of making sure the tank's full before you put the squeezers on actually does apply in this setting. Surgical challenges. Clearly, the positioning of the patient, keeping the fetus off the cava during the later stages of gestation, incision location, trocar placement, and once you're inside, exposure is quite challenging. Now to move on to the specific cases of appendicitis and gallbladder disease. Appendicitis is the most common surgical disease we'll take care of in pregnancy. It's about 1 in 2,000 to 1 in 500 pregnancies. I want to talk briefly about operative and non-operative management. Let's talk about maternal outcome. This is a H-CUP data set nationally, and you can see that the relative risk for sepsis and septic shock is substantially higher in the mother with acute appendicitis, with non-operative management of acute appendicitis. And as far as fetal outcome, this is that Taiwanese database, again, shows a dramatic increase in fetal loss rate with non-operative management. And quite honestly, there is absolutely no data supporting the use of non-operative management in acute appendicitis in the pregnant state. And that combined with this kind of outcome data, I will argue there is absolutely no role for non-operative management in the pregnant patient. In fact, delay in operative management is consequential. This data set out of UCLA showed a 67% increase in rupture rate just by waiting 24 hours. Now, this is quite old. Two decades later, at Mount Sinai, the rupture rate is lower, probably due to improved diagnosis, but it's still high at delayed intervention. So delaying the intervention does increase the rupture rate, and as I said earlier, pus in the pelvis doesn't mix well with a gravid uterus, and this data shows a substantially higher maternal and fetal mortality rate with rupture. But this is also old data. More recently, the fetal loss rate with perforated appendicitis is not as profound, but it's still substantially high. So early intervention is desirable. So if you have appendicitis with a pregnant patient, operate on them and operate on them early. What about laparoscopically? Maternal complications are lower primarily in the category of wound complications, fewer wound complications. As far as fetal complication rate, there may be a slightly lower risk of preterm labor. Honestly, the data is not very compelling, but we can certainly conclude that laparoscopic appendectomy is safe in the setting of pregnancy. What about your port access? The data on this is weak. I'm not going to present it here. It's on the SAGES website. But whatever method of accessing the peritoneal cavity that you're comfortable with is reasonable. I recommend the use of intraoperative ultrasound for trocar placement and initial access. You can safely insufflate CO2. End-tidal CO2 monitoring is a standard of care in anesthesia and is wise. Let's shift gears and talk about gallstone disease. It's the second most common obstetrical surgical disorder. Gallstones are common in pregnancy, and cholecystitis is also one of the more common problems. How do we manage it? Well, honestly, the same as in the non-pregnant state, laparoscopic cholecystectomy. And there's plenty of data similar to this that shows improved outcome with laparoscopic cholecystectomy. And that can be done regardless of trimester, depending upon your comfort level. What about symptomatic cholelithiasis? Historically, conservative management, and in this case, conservative management means non-operative management, has been the standard. But it's very clear that observing these patients, you'll see recurrence of their symptoms quite frequently. And the recurrence rate is a function of when they presented. There is some other data that might suggest second trimester has the highest risk of recurrence, but in any event, there are recurrences throughout pregnancy, and more recent data shows an overall recurrence rate of symptoms of 60%. And in addition, those patients are more likely to return to the emergency department and be hospitalized, and there is a much higher cesarean section rate, although from this data, we can't tell if that's emergency sections or planned sections coordinating definitive surgical care. So if you're being conservatively managed for biliary colic, how do your symptoms represent? Do they come back as biliary colic, or do they come back worse as cholecystitis or gallstone pancreatitis? In this data set out of UCSF, if you presented with biliary colic, 57% of the patients did represent with symptoms, And 35% of those patients came back with biliary colic. But 22% of the patients came back with either acute cholecystitis or gallstone pancreatitis. If you presented with acute cholecystitis, you came back as acute cholecystitis. And if you presented with gallstone pancreatitis, you came back as gallstone pancreatitis. And this data set, a decade later, the recurrence rate appears to be slightly lower, but it's still substantially high. And so if you present with biliary colic, you could expect 35% of the time you'll come back as biliary colic. And there's a substantially real rate of presentation as acute cholecystitis or gallstone pancreatitis. So what does that mean? If you have your pregnant patient with biliary colic, what do you do? These patients do have some adverse maternal outcome by your choice of conservative management, but the outcome is primarily premature labor, and I have not been able to uncover any compelling data that shows adverse fetal outcomes from that delay. The SAGE's opinion is biliary colic should result in laparoscopic cholecystectomy regardless of trimester. And interestingly, many of the papers cited, including this one, which was published relatively recently, still shows that even at centers that are looking for this kind of data, 93% of the patients are still non-operatively managed. So what do you do? I think that the risk of serious complications from the gallstone disease is real, and I think it requires a true and honest conversation with the patient. The patient needs to be involved and understand the risks and make a decision with you as to whether they wish to undergo elective cholecystectomy during their gestation or try to risk waiting until the end. A few special considerations in the remaining time. Timing of surgery. If the surgery is emergent, you do it regardless of trimester. The fact that a woman is pregnant should not deny her a necessary surgical intervention. If the surgery is truly elective, the old teaching of postpone until delivery or do in the second trimester is still reasonable. What if you're at a medical center or a hospital that does not have obstetrical or neonatal services and you're presented with a pregnant patient who needs an operation? Well, if the fetus is pre-viable, and as we heard, that depends upon the capabilities in your center, but it's generally around 23 to 24 weeks, go ahead and proceed with the intervention. We're not going to do anything differently at a center that has these services. If the fetus is viable, and you believe that delay would result in adverse maternal or fetal outcome, proceed with the surgical intervention, but arrange for post-procedural transport. If this procedure is non-emergent, consult with the obstetrical services and the surgical services at your receiving institution. What about fetal monitoring? We heard about that briefly. If the fetus is pre-viable, you should just check for fetal heart tones preoperatively and postoperatively. But if the fetus is viable, you should at least do formal contraction and fetal heart rate monitoring preoperatively and postoperatively. If the case allows you to monitor intraoperatively, and that information might result in an alteration in the conduct of the operation, then go ahead and keep the monitor on during the case. So in summary, imaging, ultrasound, it's fast, it's easy, it's safe, frequently non-diagnostic, but should be done. MRI is the gold standard, but if you need a CT scan, go ahead and get it. Appendicitis, these patients should be operatively managed, laparoscopically or open, and they're not patients that should undergo observation or be delayed. The surgery should be done expeditiously. Cholecystitis, it's laparoscopic cholecystectomy, just like in the non-pregnant state. And symptomatic cholelithiasis, that really requires a dialogue with your patient, involve them in the decision-making. The disease is likely to recur. If we do everything correctly, this is the outcome we should expect.